Welcome, everyone. Thanks to coming to Dhammaloka on what in Australia is a fairly wettish, wintry day. Hopefully, I'm going to warm you up with some good stories and an interactive session on good, bad, who knows. We did a session earlier in the year, but some people have asked that we go back to the book and cover some other stories that weren't mentioned on the day. So I hope this really appeals to you and you could really benefit from the next 45 minutes. In preparing for today, I thought to myself, I wonder how I could introduce today's session. And I'd like you to think about using the book itself as a meditative practice. Every time that you consider using the book to help yourself. So humor me for a second and imagine that the book is in your bag. You haven't been having such a great day. You've got some questions at the back of your mind. And you think out, you'll reach out for this book called Good, Bad, Who Knows to see if it answers any questions. So if we were to meditate on the book, use the book as a meditation object, the first thing you might do is get the book out of your bag. Oh, it's got an interesting cover. I wonder why it's called Good, Bad, Who Knows. That's an interesting title. Good is in red. Bad is in blue or black, depending on whether your eyesight is good. Mine's not so good. It's an interesting visual. It's got what looks like a seesaw with lots of stones on one side that look like beautiful zafu cushions, but it's precariously balanced, and it's certainly overweighted on one side. And it's also got this color prism across the bottom, which kind of is never the same in any icon as it moves from sort of left to right or from right to left. So the book intrigues me. What do I think about it? Oh, it's got a beautiful typeface. Smells fresh. And the metaphor with the book is, before you dive in and kind of look for something that would help you in your practice or answer a question, you might sort of set an intention of, why have I picked up the book? And I think in the present day, we can sort of rush from event to event. There are so many distractions. If you picked up your mobile phone, if you're on the computer, if you didn't get satisfaction from a certain item, you may quickly go to something else. And you haven't sort of stayed present in the moment or understood what that interaction between the subject and the object was. In lay life many years ago, I enjoyed developing internet websites. And we did a bit of research to understand what was people's attention span when they first came to a website. So we knew how to design the site for maximum impact, and it drew in the attention of the observer and gave them quickly the information they wanted. Now, when I did that study, which must be close to 15 years ago, we discovered that what was known as the eyeball retention rate was only 13 seconds. If somebody didn't find what they were looking for in 13 seconds, they would move off somewhere else. Now that seems to be less than 4 or 5 seconds. So with the amount of social media stimulus and the like, what I'm recommending here, you know, with this book, with the session, is to say, stand back, start to ground yourself as you pick up the book and ask yourself how it would really be a benefit for me today? And is there something that I'm looking for in this vessel, you know, which is a well-written, humorous, and thoughtful book? Are there elements in here that I can take into my practice, I can share with friends, I can discuss, you know, with my colleagues in monastic life or even within BSWA? And the other thing that struck me was when I kind of went to pick up the book, one of the things that the Buddha taught, one of the things that Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Ramali would stress is, with mindfulness, isn't it great, or wouldn't it be great, if you remained a short distance from your thoughts or your feelings? That the book could be a metaphor for your own mind and say, I need to step back, there's some distance, have some distance between what I'm observing, and I won't get sucked in, I won't take everything on the written page as being true. There's a good exercise to say, let me look at it, let me consider it, let me not fall back into eyeball retention rates and rush on to the next story and look for the next hit of dopamine or the next upsurge of a good feeling with inside me. Was there something in a sentence there? Was there something in the idea that's being put across that I could reflect on and pause? So what I'm going to suggest today, different to the last session, and I don't know if it was good for me or not, but I went and reviewed last time what was the session last time, and I wondered if we got through a lot of information fairly quickly, but we didn't have the time to pause, reflect, and pause on what we just studied. So what I'm going to recommend this afternoon, is to say, let's go through a story or share them with each other, but when the story is finished and the dialogue between us has stopped, we could pause, reflect for 20 or 30 seconds, reset ourselves, and then pause again before we go to pick up another story. So I thought that might help. And the observation I've got as we go through today's session is, if we look at a story, you can read the story now, and here in Perth it's 1:53 in the afternoon. You read the story and you'll have a visceral experience right now in the present moment. What would happen if I went back to that story at 6 o'clock tonight? If I went back and reviewed that story at 6 o'clock tonight, would I have a different experience, or would it have landed deeper? That it's certainly there was something that impressed me, but if I'm not careful, I can put it all back into the bag, and I've just had a simple experience, but I haven't taken out anything out of it. I've just consumed time. I put it away and I've immediately forgot about it. Does that seem okay? Can we sort of have that dialogue again and share between each other? And, you know, I'd love to hear from you any stories that you've picked out in the book or that you want to talk about or discuss a deeper meaning. So let me ask that we set an intention. Just sit quietly for a minute, and then I'll talk about a couple of stories that have influenced me since we spoke last. So let's just close our eyes for just 1 minute. Just before you open your eyes, just set an intention, what you'd like to get from this session. And at the end of the session, just check in with yourself as to whether that intention was met. So a couple of things I wanted to offer today. I noticed when I reviewed the first session on Good, Bad, Who Knows, we tended to concentrate on loving kindness, kindfulness, and some that weren't covered so much, but which I think speak very strongly in the book, are wisdom, contemplation, and cultivation. So I want to give you a story from each one, and I'd love your feedback as we go through these, and perhaps dialogue on what resonates for you from these stories, and does it benefit your practice? The first one is under the category of wisdom. And remember, at the beginning of the book, if you need it, Ajahn Brahm put out about 10 categories if you were looking for a teaching in a certain set. Then go there for wisdom, loving kindness, kindfulness, etc. This one's in wisdom. Sometimes in life you don't step in the poo, someone throws it on top of you. The following story gives advice on what to do in such a situation. This is number 5 in the book. A politician was strolling through the woods when he fell into a disused well. I pick politicians, I guess you know why, given the recent election. Fortunately, the well was dry and his skull was so thick that he incurred no injury when he fell. Unfortunately, the well was too deep for him to climb out himself, so he screamed for help. Usually, a person would come hoarse after yelling for a couple of hours, but because he was a professional politician with many years' experience, he could shout for 3 hours and he was only then getting into his stride. A farmer came along, heard the noise, and discovered the politician at the bottom of the well. "Help me," said the politician. "No way," replied the farmer, recognizing him. The farmer hated politicians, especially ultra sleazy ones like this one. Moreover, he'd always meant to fill that dangerous well. So he got out a spade and started shoveling dirt into the well. He'd bury the politician and plug the well at the same time. When the politician felt the mug being thrown on top of him, it was nothing unusual to him. Nevertheless, when he realized that the farmer's intention was to bury him alive, his screaming went to a higher level, normally only heard at election time. "I promise I'll never lower your taxes. I guarantee I'll increase farm subsidies. I swear I'll grant all the cows free health cover. Trust me." On hearing those words, "trust me," the farmer became shoveling the dirt into the well even more vigorously. The politician began to shout more desperately, then he went quiet. The farmer thought he must have buried that politician, so carried on shoveling at an easier speed. But then the farmer noticed something rather strange. First, he saw a strand of hair above the top of the well. As he shoveled more, the crown of a head appeared. Then after he put more earth into the well, he saw the smiling head of the politician. The politician had decided to stop complaining at having dirt thrown in him. Instead, he'd shake off the mud and compact it under his feet. That way, every shovelful of dirt would be shrugged off his shoulders, trodden into the ground, and he would stand a few centimeters higher. So soon he was high enough to jump out of the well and reward the farmer with visits from the health and safety department, as well as from the tax department. The moral of the story is that when life shovels shit on you, shrug it off, tread it in, and you'll always stand higher in life. Now, I led it off with that one because that, to me, kind of speaks to good, bad, who knows. Any politicians watching, forgive me for the mischievous humor. In fact, I'm going to make a really good politician tomorrow, who is Sam Lim, who was elected locally in federal parliament and is probably the first Buddhist MP in federal parliament now. But the politician is used as a euphemism to say difficult issues can land on anyone. And we can either sulk, get really angry, respond badly, or say, well, in the predicament I'm in at the moment, what's the most sensible and beneficial thing to do? And in this scenario, the politician goes, ah, I notice if I keep pounding down the mud and stuff, then I rise out of the well, and then I'm free again. So wisdom doesn't naturally come to us when our mind is disturbed, when we haven't created that separation in terms of what event is happening to me. Is it a crisis? Is it fairly minor? How can I handle it? So I think that's a great one in terms of take the meaning behind the joke and the story and say, I have many ways in which to respond. And if we tag that with the Dharma and the teachings that you get here from Ajahn Brahm or any male or female monk that you would visit, you know, the first part of the Eightfold Path is to renounce all the difficulties in the world and then only apply loving kindness or compassion. So it's a truth of life that all sorts of strange and difficult things will turn up, often when you sort of least expect it. So see if you can find your wisdom mind fairly quickly. And if you can't, depart the situation and then come back to it when you can. So I'll come back to that in a second, and I'd love your observations. Contemplation, and there's a little bit of a segue here from the dirt to how to be a chicken farmer. So number eight, we didn't talk much about contemplation last time, but I noticed that Ajahn Brahm had, you know, 10, 15 different items under contemplation, and I think this is one, you know, of his most famous ones. How to be a chicken farmer. Once there were two chicken farmers. The first rose early in the morning, picked up a basket, and went into the chicken shed to collect the produce from the night before. He proceeded to fill his basket with chicken poo, leaving the eggs on the ground to rot. He then brought the basket of chicken poo back into the house, where it made a very bad smell. His family was very upset with that stupid chicken farmer. The second chicken farmer picked up a basket and entered his chicken shed, also to collect the produce of the night before. But he filled up his basket with eggs, leaving the chicken shit to rot in the shed. It would become valuable fertilizer later, but you don't bring it into the house with you. Bringing only the eggs back home, he could cook a delicious omelet for his family and later sold the remaining eggs in the market for cash. His family was very pleased with that clever chicken farmer. The meaning of this parable is, when you collect the produce of your past, what do you put in your basket and bring home with you? Are you one of those people who collect all the unpleasant experiences of today or of your life and bring them home with you? Darling, I got caught by the speed camera today. Honey, the boss was really angry at me at work. Or are you someone who leaves all those negative experiences in the past where they belong and only recollect the happy moments? Are you a poo collector or an egg collector? So those stories are only a couple of pages apart in the book, but I noticed going through the book that some are interrelated with others. And it's almost like a patchwork quilt. If we go back to what I was suggesting at the beginning of the session, if you'd picked up this book again or went to the bookshop and got it, you're probably holding it in your hands looking for an answer to something. So it's very helpful to see and find a section that might help you. And then if the first story under contemplation doesn't help, then go to another one. But also referencing one against the other, you could say, gee, I wonder if the politician held on to that story of being covered in earth, or he turned it to a joke in many speeches he gave, you know, on his next election campaign, or he gave a talk about it in Parliament. If you're that short distance from the mind and you're examining your thoughts and what's going on in your consciousness, then you get to choose. But I think in the present day, it's about having that ability to say, I have to stop. I have to stop. I have to center myself. And even if I feel a bit agitated in my body, I've had a bad experience on something, how can I allow myself to calm down? If I can't calm down completely, can a story like this help me? And if something goes in, but it's not really given me the full solution, then perhaps put the book down and go back to it 2 or 3 hours later. And cultivation. Cultivation's an interesting one. Cultivation is really important for us as monastics because, you know, I, like many, come with all my faults and habits and kind of problems from lay life, you know, when I show up. And gradually you understand that it would be really helpful to cultivate some new habits and observe people around you who seem to evoke happiness and loving kindness and tenderness, and ask yourself, where is that coming from? And then start to notice, if they're like that most days, is that a better way to live than some of the habits that I thought were me, Metaji, or in lay life I was called Stephen? Did those habits really work for me previously? So the cultivation section and rereading it, you know, in preparing for this, cultivation kind of points to, are there some skills here that the Buddha recommended that the monastics try and practice, that the lay supporters in BSWA and those of you watching on YouTube around the world, cultivating practices that can reduce the amount of suffering. You know, I really like the phraseology that's behind me that is so simple and yet so profound as the clue to what we should cultivate. You know, be peaceful, be kind, be gentle to every moment. You've always got the opportunity to respond in that way. So let me share what I think is one of the best pieces in here on cultivation. And it's called Someone Is Watching You. Some of you may well remember it. I think it's a great story. In the ancient world, a single wise teacher would teach a group of students everything they needed to know about life. One such teacher had a dozen students who were close to graduation. He also had a daughter whom all his students thought was hot. One day he announced to his students that he had two problems. The first was that he had to find a husband for his daughter, and according to the tradition of those days, it should be one of his 12 students. The difficulty was he couldn't decide which student would make the best husband. The second problem was that he, as the father of the bride, would have to pay for a lavish wedding ceremony and also set up the new couple in a new house with all the necessities. The difficulty was that this was a great expense. To solve both those problems, the teacher announced a contest. He asked his students to creep stealthily into the local village in the blindness of night and steal whatever they could, as long as no one saw them. Then they would bring all the goods back to the teacher. Whichever student followed the instructions and stole the most would win his daughter, and all the stolen valuables would go to the happy couple. The students were shocked that their teacher was asking him to steal. He was usually such a moral man. In those days, though, so important was the vow of obedience to one's teacher that they accepted the contest. Or perhaps it was that all young men had fallen in love with his drop-dead gorgeous daughter. Over the next 7 days, the cunning students snuck into the village late at night, stole what they could, and brought it back to the teacher. The teacher kept a careful record of which students stole what and from which house. Amazingly, no student got caught in the act. At the end of the week, the teacher assembled the students to announce the result. "You've stolen so much," began the teacher. "Enough for any couple to get a good start in life, except for one of you who's not brought back anything at all. Why not?" The shy young student came forward and said, "Because I had to follow your instructions, sir." "What do you mean? Did I not instruct you to steal and bring the goods back to me?" "Yes, sir," said the downcast student, "but you also instructed us to steal as long as no one sees you. I crept into many houses at 2 o'clock in the morning when everyone was fast asleep, but every time I was about to steal something, I noticed someone seeing me, so I had to leave empty-handed, sir." "If everyone in the house was sleeping, who was watching you, student?" asked the teacher. "I was watching me, sir. I could see that I was about to steal. That is why I took nothing. You told us only to steal as long as no one sees you." Very good," explained the delighted teacher. "At least I have one wise student who's been listening to me all these years. All of the rest of you nincompoops take all the stolen goods back to their owners. They won't punish you. I told them about the contest 2 weeks ago. They were expecting you. That is why none of you were caught. And remember, whatever immoral act you ever do, someone will always see you, and that someone is yourself. Because you see it, you will feel bad and suffer." Of course, the wise student married the beautiful daughter. The teacher was wealthy enough to give them an opulent wedding ceremony and a well-furnished dream house. Then, because the husband was truly wise, they actually did live happily ever after. So we didn't get to that last time around, but the principles of there are ideas in here to cultivate, and again, they're pretty profound teachings. A monastic can spend many hours on their own. Lay people can spend many hours on their own in solitary meditation or going about their day. But we are aware of what we're doing. At least we should try to be. And there are elements to be cultivated that takes you deeper into the practice, that underscores the Eightfold Path, that enables the meditations to go deeper. And, you know, the first time I read that, that hit me quite strongly, saying, yeah, if I was in a difficult situation and I had a choice to criticize someone or find out why it was they were suffering, I can notice that in myself. I can notice that I'm just about to perhaps use harsh language when I shouldn't. I can see it myself that I perhaps should try loving kindness 10, 15 times before I ever sort of went to criticism. So how do those stories resonate with the audience? Give me some feedback and any other stories related to these in the book that speak to you. And perhaps we can bring a microphone round if someone would like to talk or say something. Can we have a mic from the back? Oh, just go up the front. Oh, I beg your pardon. Sorry, I couldn't see that. Please. Is the microphone on? Were you going to say something? Oh, I'm sorry. You had the technical difficulty. Anybody want to share on those stories or something that speaks to them in the book?
Venerable, when you read the first story about the politician, what struck me was that to be able to shake off the poo that's thrown to you, you must have good things that you've done so that you can reflect on the good things to be able to shrug off the bad. But so if you don't have that in you, then shrugging off the bad would be harder or almost impossible. So I think we all want to be able to shrug off the bad, But often we're not strong enough to recall the goodness that we've done. We think we need to do big, good things, but the little ones are important to help us in our daily life.
Have you got a good experience that happened to you that you've managed to catch that in yourself that you'd share with the room?
I can't think of one right now, but I think very often I am hard on myself if I say the wrong thing and I think, oh, I shouldn't have said that, I could be a better person. But it's only when I've beaten up myself enough that I go away and think, hang on, I'm not that bad a person, I may have made a mistake and I should be better next time.
So thanks for the observations. I think it's really helpful. There are a number of good politicians that lost their seats that were really well regarded in their communities, and there's one in the Australian version of The Guardian today who's written a piece saying, you know, I was in Parliament, you know, for 6 years and everything seemed to be going okay, and within 90 minutes of the election night, I knew it was over. And he's written a piece on the basis of reflecting of the good and the bad, like what emotions he's going through, and he thinks he might need to process that for a period of time. Interestingly, from my observation, he was really caring about other people, like his election staff that had lost their job. You know, they'd worked for him for years, but when he finished as the MP, then the office and all those financial supports that you get because of the MP are gone, so you can't keep the staff going. And he hadn't necessarily reflected on himself and what good he'd done. And I think he did that on the basis of he could reflect that he'd met many very big egos, but he didn't want to be a big ego himself. That's the first observation. The second one, if we talked about eyeball retention times earlier, the mind even works faster. So consciousness happens so fast, your connection, eye, ear, nose, none of them are switched on at the same time. They're flicking from one to the other, and it's kind of like millionths of a second. So it's actually quite hard to train the mind to say, I've just been insulted or somebody's throwing dirt on me, I'm going to remember the nice thing I did 12 years ago. But the flip side of that is, I think by having practice, by having sila, by saying, okay, I'll choose to love from a position of metta, loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy or even equanimity, if you can kind of remember that or train that in a number of times, then once or twice you'll go there. So much like an athlete trains for the Olympics or a top sport or even someone doing an exam, if you practice in a way which isn't stressful and, you know, you're beating yourself up, I must train myself to be strong next time. No, I'll train myself to have loving kindness and go, I don't have to engage on the difficult ones. For me, in lay life, if I'd have known some of this stuff earlier, I would have treated some disagreements with females, you know, partners of the other sex, differently. And one thing that impressed me 20 plus years ago now, Thich Nhat Hanh had something called a peace treaty. It was in one of his books. And he said, say if a couple, you know, same-sex couple, heterosexual couple, you know, whatever combinations, if they fell out and there was a really angry incident, one could say to the other, look, I'm feeling quite upset at the moment, or you're angry, I'm upset. Today's Saturday, can we have an agreement that I'm going to take care of my upset and you take care of your anger? And we'll meet 4 days from now to discuss it. And we'll just sign this little piece of paper that, you know, this is what we think the issue is about. And put some distance in place to then reflect on it and go, okay, in the meantime, I could think about their better qualities, or did I cause it? Was it something, you know, unintentionally I did? And someone I met in lay life, when they came together for that conversation, they did a great thing. Imagine this is a box of tissues. They put the box of tissues on a table and they would sit side by side with each other to have that discussion 4 days later. And one had said to the other, "Now that's the issue on the table. Let's describe what the issue is. But we're sitting over here. It's not about us, it's about the issue." It's like Ajahn Brahm saying, when you get married, don't think about yourself going forward. Don't think about the other person. Think about us. So the actual, you know, the way the environment was set up and saying, let's discuss the issue without being rude to each other, insulting. And if we don't resolve it tonight, let's have a cup of tea, watch something nice together, go for a walk in the park, and come back a week on Thursday, that type of stuff. So yeah, that was brilliant. Thanks for bringing that up. So we've all got that, right? Any other observations? Have you got a favorite story at the front? Would you like to take the mic? Here we go. Is it
on? I just want to make a comment about the same story. I've heard another version of the story from Ajahn Brahm, but it wasn't a politician, it was a donkey that went into the well and the farmer didn't want to help it out. So the donkey did the same as the politician and it got out eventually and gave a big kick for the farmer in his backside as thank you for nothing. So they're a bit similar, but different but similar. So it tells us that maybe if life is too hard, just keep on going, see the bigger picture, want to live.
Yeah, I was being mildly mischievous, you know, the politician, because there'd been a recent election in Australia, but Ajahn Brahm may well tell the same story, but just adapt it to the situation. Yeah. So if someone comes and asks for counseling, he's got this great way. I didn't realize, you know, he says when somebody comes to see him and they're not traveling too well, first he tries to understand where they may be at mentally, and secondly, where they may be at spiritually. And then that will give him clues as to how he should phrase things back. So one time he may tell the joke from the politician point of view, another time it may be from the donkey. But he's often trying to get into those mind processes and say, the bulk of what I teach is loving kindness and compassion. Would you give it to yourself first? And then if you gave it to yourself first and you were safe and you felt as though you're in a good position, then you could probably go and help other people. Yeah. So has anybody got a story that they'd like to share today from the book? A new one? I've just got a few more if you'd like to hear them, but I'd love to hear from... While you're having a quick look, I'll share two more, you know, also for the audience listening in. Those of you know me, that you wouldn't be surprised that I'm a real sucker for meta stories and sort of loving kindness. So here's one that I'd like to share today that I think is really, really helpful. Number 35, little acts of kindness. A senior surgeon in a prestigious hospital in the USA examined the referred woman's medical record. Her cancer was advanced and every other hospital in the region had given up on her. Any treatment would be complex, expensive, and there was only a small chance that she would survive. Having checked her details and after making a few more inquiries, he took on the difficult case. His fellow doctors were surprised at the amount of resources he was willing to commit to the treatment of the woman. He called in many favors to assemble top specialists from other parts of the US and dedicated so much of his limited time and energy into helping this one patient. The doctor's extraordinary efforts paid off. At the end of many months, he could tell that the cancer was in full remission and that she could expect to live many more happy years. She was overjoyed. A few days later, she received the bill from the hospital in the mail. She opened the envelope with dread, expecting to see a fee somewhere in the order of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Instead, she saw in her doctor's own handwriting, paid 25 years ago with a glass of milk and two cookies. 25 years previously, that doctor had been a poor medical student trying to pay his way through college doing odd jobs. One such job was a door-to-door salesman. Late one hot afternoon, having sold nothing at all, he knocked on yet another door and a woman opened it. She listened to his worn sales pitch and declined to buy anything. But then she asked the tired-looking young man, "Have you had anything to eat yet?" "Not since breakfast, ma'am." "Then you just wait there," she said, and she quickly returned with a glass of milk and two cookies for the exhausted young medical student. 25 years later, the student was a senior surgeon at a prestigious hospital in the US. When he examined the referred woman's medical record, her name rang a bell. A few phone calls confirmed that she was indeed the kind lady who'd given him the welcome snack when he was selling door to door. Out of gratitude for a little act of kindness many years before, but never forgotten, not only did he go the extra distance to make sure she survived the cancer, but he also paid the bill. Isn't that wonderful? And I know of, you know, other stories in other people's lives that we've heard about, or, you know, when I was in lay life. So little acts of kindness, not even as big as that, you know, can make an enormous difference. And, you know, they're so heartwarming to somebody, you know, who's down on their luck, who's had, you know, a bad diagnosis. And we're such a big community now, we often know as someone that we can go and talk to, even for good or better advice, even if we can't, you know, help with financials. But in my experience as well, I mean, the holding of the kindness, you know, for someone else to be in their corner while they're going through the difficulties, you know, that can make an enormous difference. And it sits well with the path that we want to walk on, and try and live from that aspiration day by day. Any questions? Do you recommend the book to others? Can I ask that? Yeah? Tell me why you recommend it and what you find interesting.
A lot of the stories are written in such a simple form, but if we all did what you suggested, take time to read it, reflect, and come back to it, the stories are actually very profound. But it's just the way it's written, it's so simple, and it makes it very easy reading.
Yeah.
That's what I like about it. And it's very practical stories.
Yeah.
It could affect. I mean, it does affect many of us many times over.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, hopefully in this short session, I've given you some pointers in terms of how you can look at the story, how you can sit back from it and say, I mean, as a minimum, I might just give you an uplifting moment and saying, that's going to get me through the rest of the day, and I don't have a solution to the dilemma in front of me, but that gives me a feeling of meta. That makes me feel a bit more comfortable with life, or, that's an idea. Who was that person that kind of helped me out 5 or 10 years ago? I wonder if I could give them a ring, and they'd be the right advice, you know, for the plumbing that's broken, or wherever that would happen to be. And I think because there's a spread of stories in here across most of the teachings that the Buddha and BSWA would like to espouse, then you can go back to it time and time again. And this, and opening the door of your heart, it's accessible, you know, two keystrokes on the internet. If you feel a bit panicked in the middle of the night, or, you know, want something to help out. So I'm going to finish with one of my favorites. I don't think there'll probably be a good, bad, who knows, part three, but parts one and two were very enjoyable. And if you've got any comments or feedback, for us, please send it to bswa.org or in the comments field on YouTube. So this one always puts me in a good spot. So let's see if it has the same feeling for you as it did for me. It's called Half a Sheet of Paper, and it's about compassion. This is Ajahn Brahm talking. Many years ago, I read the following inspiring story of how a man overcame his anger and lack of self-esteem. A widow was presenting the eulogy at her husband's funeral service. She held up a dog-eared half sheet of paper, explaining that her husband had kept it in his wallet since before they were married, and that it had prevented him from getting angry at others or becoming negative towards himself. Her husband had told her that when he was a teenager attending an all-boys high school, a major fight was about to break out in his classroom. It had been brewing for days. The teacher used the last opportunity to exert her authority, to order every student to stay at their desk and carefully tear out a page from their exercise books. Then she told them to write at the top of the page the name of the boy in the class that they hated the most. They all obeyed. Then she ordered them to draw a neat vertical line down the middle of the page, and on the left-hand side of that line, write the reasons why they hated that boy so much. Her class happily followed that instruction too. Now she commanded, on the right-hand side of the line, write the things you admire and respect about that boy you hate the most. That was very hard for the boys to do. She had to force them to complete the task. Fold your piece of paper now carefully along the vertical line was the next instruction, and tear it in half. I will come around with the waste paper basket. The left-hand pieces of paper where you've written all the reasons why you hate your enemy, I want you to place them in the waste basket. The right-hand pieces of paper where you've written the things you respect and admire about your enemy, you must politely hand it to them. Do it. The widow explained that the old half sheet of paper that she was holding up was the right-hand piece that her husband's worst enemy at high school had given him, describing all the things he respected and admired in her husband when he was a boy. Her husband would refer to that half sheet of paper whenever he was about to get angry. If this was what his worst enemy could see in him, maybe could he bring himself to see some redeeming qualities in his own enemies. When he was close to becoming depressed, he thought that if my enemy can see such fine characteristics to admire in me, then maybe I can see them too. That's why he kept the half sheet of paper with him all his life. It made him a contented man. So if you don't like yourself, get out a sheet of paper, draw a line down the center, write the things you don't like about yourself on the left-hand side and the things you like about yourself on the right-hand side. You must fill the right side, then tear it in half, throw away the left side, and keep the right portion. Refer to it regularly. It will provide you self-esteem and also save you a lot of money by not having to go to psychologists. As a postscript to the story, which isn't in this book, I discovered that the lady who, talking at her husband's funeral, when the funeral finished, three of his mates that had stayed friends for 50 years walked up and they all had their own half sheet of paper still in their wallets. So that might be a lovely place to finish. Hopefully in these two sessions, I've given you some tips in taking a book, using it as part of your Dharma practice, going back to it time and time again. For me, I can read a story for the seventh or the eighth time and it drops in a bit differently. So I hope you find these book clubs valuable. We're always open to feedback. We're always open to doing new sessions that might help you. So with that, let me close the session, and I'd just like us to pay respect to the Buddha by bowing three times before we close. So thank you very much.